from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with Vermont poet and author Erica Nichols Fraser, who is the editor of a new collection, A Tether to This World, Stories and Poems About Recovery, published by Main Street Rag. And later in the hour, we will hear from a contributor to that collection, the poet A.E. Hines. Erica Nichols Fraser is a developmental editor at New Degree Press and the communications manager at the Children's Literacy Foundation. She has an MFA from the Bennington Writing Seminars. She won Noir Nation's 2020 Golden Fedora Fiction Prize and has been nominated for a Pushcart Prize. Her work has appeared in HuffPost, Lunate, Red Tree Review, and elsewhere. She is a reader for Literary Orphans and a judge for NYC Midnight. She lives in Vermont with her husband, dogs, cat, and chickens. A.E. Hines is a gay poet living in Portland, Oregon. He is a recent Pushcart nominee, and his work has appeared in numerous publications, including Atlanta Review, California Quarterly, and the Briarcliff Review. He was the 2020 winner of the Red Wheelbarrow Poetry Prize. I spoke with Erica Nichols Fraser and A.E. Hines last week. Our interview begins with my first question for Erica. A.E. Hines, whose name is Earl, joins us a bit later. I hope you enjoy our conversation. All right, so I thought we'd start with this. So there's a piece in the collection, and wouldn't it be great if I had written down the title? But anyway, this is a quote.
I can probably help you with it.
Yeah, I bet you can. So this piece in the collection, which is memoir, starts out, according to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, one out of every five adults in America will experience a mental illness. So I thought that seemed like a good place to start the conversation.
Yeah, I believe that's Richard Bray's Suffering in Silence.
Yes, that's right. So that was an interesting statistic, and I want to talk a little bit later too about the stigma of mental illness, but particularly in the context of, you know, just how many people suffer from this. And I think in your introduction, you also talk about some of the statistics of it. Mm-hmm. You know, and obviously it's not all just one thing, but let's just start there. Do you want to just talk a little bit about why you started to work on this collection and those numbers and how they inform this collection?
Sure. Well, I'm bipolar, and I've had an eating disorder in the past. So mental illness is something that's been a part of my life for a long time, and something that I've really come to terms with and started talking about openly in the last few years. So as I was kind of thinking about my own experiences and saw some of the numbers, you know, I do say in the introduction, about 47 million Americans deal with mental illness, you know, and as I started to think about that, it occurred to me that there are so many of these stories that are similar to mine. There are so many people out there suffering and struggling with mental illness and family members who are struggling with mental illness that I thought, you know, what a powerful thing it would be to share some of those stories, to compile them and to offer to folks who are struggling, you know, some hope, some idea that they might be able to recover and to live a full life despite these challenges.
Yeah. And so how did you become the editor of this collection? Did you go to Main Street Rag and say, I want to put this together?
Yeah. So I started thinking about this idea as I was on vacation in early March last year, just before COVID really came to a head. I was on a ski trip with my husband in Colorado. And so I was thinking about some things I wanted to write about my own mental illness and my experiences with bipolar disorder. And then it occurred to me that there are so many of these stories out there. And I thought, what a gift it would be to offer these stories to readers. So I went home, I did a little research on presses and found Main Street Rag and pitched the idea to them on March 14th. And on March 15th, the editor, Scott Douglas, got back to me and said, let's do it. So it was one of those things that it just kind of worked out, and he was supportive of it. And so it's really been a pandemic project for me, putting this whole thing together. And it's given me something positive to focus on in a difficult time.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That's so amazing that you heard back so quickly. That's great. That never happens. That's
I know. So it was sort of unheard of.
Yeah.
It was not typical.
I suppose it does happen, but it's wonderful that that does happen. So A Tether to This World is such a great title. It actually, I think, comes from the epigraph that you used at the beginning of the book, which is from a show called Nanette by Hannah Gadsby, which I was familiar with. It's such an amazing stand-up comedy show, but amazing. Also very deeply moving.
So powerful.
Yes. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the title, A Tether to This World.
Sure. Well, as you said, it comes from Hannah Gadsby's comedy special on Netflix, Nanette, in which she's telling a story of speaking about taking antidepressants at a comedy show and a stranger coming up to her afterwards and criticizing that and telling her that as an artist, she should suffer. And we wouldn't have the sunflowers if Vincent van Gogh had medicated. And well, she, as an art historian, educates him that, of course, Vincent van Gogh did medicate heavily. But she says, and I say this in the introduction, she says, do you know why we have the sunflowers? It isn't because Vincent van Gogh suffered. It's because he had a brother who loved him, a tether, a connection to this world. And that's the story we need to tell, connection. And so that really inspired me and has stuck with me. And so I was thinking about what my tethers are to this world, the people who I love, the people who love me, the things I love to do, and how those have offered me tethers during the most difficult times. And so I was really searching for tethers in these pieces, for those connections to the world, for what people find that ground them and that have been positive and healing for them. And so that's what I want this book to offer to folks, you know, a tether, a connection to other people who are suffering with similar things. And so to me, that felt like a sort of inspiring and empowering title, you know, the idea that that we find our own tethers, mm-hmm. that keep us grounded and that keep us, you know, a part of the world.
Yeah, great. So how did you find artists? Did you put out a call for submissions in some way, or did you only solicit from artists that you knew?
Yeah, we put out a call of submissions. Main Street Rag put out a call for submissions on Poets and Writers and on New Pages. So that's where the majority of folks found us. A couple contributors were writers that I knew. You know, I had reached out on social media and my personal networks as well. So I do have a few writers that I had known previously who contributed as well. But for the most part, it was folks who just saw it advertised on Poets and Writers and New Pages.
So did you make new connections with these people having this experience?
Absolutely. Through their work and through working with them, I feel like I know these writers, these 38 writers, you know, so well now. And the work is also deeply personal that I feel like it has offered a connection to me and to these writers. And so many of them have been so grateful to have the space to share their stories. I do feel deeply connected to them.
Yeah. So this brings up what I think would be one of the hardest jobs of being an editor, and that is having to turn people down.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Yeah, so hard. Let's put it in terms of what maybe were a few issues that you saw that made you have to turn down good work, work that you otherwise would have liked to include that might help listeners who are trying to pull together some piece to submit? Like what might be certain things they should watch out for?
Certain things I should watch out for. I mean, I want a piece to feel complete, right? I want it to feel like there's some sort of resolution. And in these pieces, I was really looking for some glimmer of hope and the concept of recovery. So not just the most challenging times you've gone through, but also what helped you get through it, right? So I was really trying to look for some sort of positive element in here. And of course, these stories are harrowing. A lot of them are, you know, so even upsetting to read, you know, suicidal ideation or people who've been affected by suicide, hospitalization, a lot of these very difficult things. So, of course, a lot of them were quite dark, but I was looking for some, as I say, some glimmer of hope in them. In terms of what other editors should look at, as I said, a piece should feel complete. It shouldn't feel like it needs a lot more work. And I was really looking for emotional connections to the writer. So feeling like they were really being honest and open and digging deep into, you know, their experiences.
Okay, great. Let's see. Now, the book has fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. How did you go about organizing it?
Yeah, I was very pleased that we got such a good mix of prose and poetry, fiction, nonfiction, and poetry, as you say. In terms of organizing the book, I wanted there to be sort of a narrative flow, and I really wanted there to be, as I say, sort of an arc to it. The collection begins and ends with poems. Both of those poems I very deliberately selected for the beginning and ending. I wanted that first poem, David Eisenogel's Panic Attack Protocol, which I feel like really invites the reader in a physical way into the experience of a panic attack, but also ends with, you will get through this, you always do. So it sort of invites the reader in and lets them know, you know, I've been through it too. Here are some ways that you can make it through. So I was really looking for that kind of message to start off the collection. And then the collection ends with Making a Living, another poem that talks about wanting to live and really finding a person in your life that gives you that hope. The idea of, you know, she talks in that poem about, I never thought I'd make it past 19. And with you, I think about when I'm old, you know, and so it gave that sort of an arc to it, inviting the reader into that experience and then leaving them with this idea of hope and finding something to tether yourself to.
Nice. Yeah. I love talking about this stuff because, you know, I'll read a collection and I'll maybe have my own ideas about what went into it, but it's fun to hear what did go into it, really.
Yeah. And I tried to make it a mix. I tried to not, you know, do all poems in a row. I wanted to sort of mix things up a little bit. So I was very intentional about the order of the pieces and the content too. You know, several of them are about hospitalization or institutionalization. I tried to kind of balance the pieces as well.
Yeah. So what else did you do as editor? You helped to pick the pieces. You had to deliver bad news sometimes. You organized the work. What else did you do?
Yeah, so I read every piece that was submitted. We received 127 unique submissions. Some of those included up to 5 poems. So I had a lot of work to read. And I made the decision on each of those pieces, sometimes, as you say, difficult decisions. So I was the one in contact with all the writers. I did do some light copy editing, you know, but mostly I was looking for pieces that felt polished, that felt complete. Mm-hmm. I, as you said, ordered all the pieces. So struck, you know, chose the structure for the book. And then I've continued to be sort of a point person with all the authors and between the publisher. I proofed the book, proofread. So again, did some copy editing. And then I've done a lot of promotion of the book. So I've spoken to, you know, our local press and worked on, you know, we reached our goal for pre-sales for the book. So a lot of that has been, you know, advocating for the work as well. And yeah, and then I'm organizing a reading at the end of the month on May 28th as well of several of the contributors.
Oh, wonderful. Is that on Zoom?
Yeah, it will be on Zoom.
Oh, cool. Now, we are going to talk to one of your included artists, A.E. Hines, but I wonder if you can just talk about a few of the other pieces that come to mind, maybe just a few little salient points that really stood out for you as you were putting together the collection.
Sure. Richard Bray's Suffering in Silence, his essay, I thought was very important because he talks about how mental illness impacts people of color and communities of color, which I thought was something really important to address. Mm-hmm. And Tafara Brown's poem, Orange Wildflowers, also talks about violence against Black people and murder of Black people. So I thought that those were certainly important topics. In Richard Bray's essay, he talks about how the staggering statistics of how many fewer people of color seek and receive help for mental health as opposed to white people, which I thought was really, you know, stark to see those numbers. And so I thought that was important to include. One of my favorite pieces, and certainly I love all of the pieces in this collection and feel deeply connected to them, but one of my favorites is Brian Whelan's When the Light Gets In, in which he talks about his late sister, who has suffered mental illness, and he talks a little bit about his own mental illness and really in the context of, he uses sort of Mario Kart as a way to talk about it in the context of him having his daughter. So it's funny in some ways, but it's also heartbreaking. And he talks about, you know, his daughter giving him a purpose. And so that piece was particularly touching. I also love Kim McQueen's piece, Monkey Bars, in which she talks about postpartum depression and anxiety, which I also thought was really important to address. Another thing I love about this collection is that there are quite a few pieces from LGBTQ writers. And the statistics again show that LGBTQ youth in particular experience mental illness at a much higher rate than cisgendered heterosexual peers. And that's for a number of reasons, based from homophobia to discrimination to a lot of, you know, different factors. But it was really important to me to represent those experiences too. So whether it's A.E. Hines' piece, whether it's Mike Alvarez's piece, Lissa Brown's piece. So a number of pieces address LGBTQ mental health as well. Okay. And that was really important to me.
And I should mention, since you mentioned her name and her piece, Kim McQueen is a local writer with whom we're both acquainted. And my listeners are acquainted with her as well because she is an occasional guest host on Write the Book.
I love her piece.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the stigma of mental illness. And, you know, I feel like one of the most valuable aspects of a collection like this will be just, you know, making it feel like, you know, I know this person. I know this person. This person is my sister, my cousin, my friend.
Right.
Let's just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think the stigma around mental illness is one of the most dangerous things that our society faces, honestly. You know, more than 50,000 Americans die by suicide each year, and that's 50,000, in my opinion, preventable deaths, right? And so I think that the stigma around mental illness and the barriers to talking about it, to receiving help, you know, that is much needed, is hugely problematic. And I think that it makes many folks internalize their pain and their suffering and not feel that they can talk about it even with the people close to them, you know, and so it can be very isolating. It can be, you know, bring a lot of shame about. And that is one thing that Richard Wright talks about as well in his essay on the shame around communities of color, particular, talking about mental illness. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the most important things we can do, and certainly there are a lot of things that need to be done to advocate for mental health and appropriate mental health treatment, is to talk about it and to talk about our own experiences. And as you say, to say, this is me, this is my brother, this is my wife, this is my sister, you know, this is people in your lives that you know who are struggling with it. I have had an essay published by OC87 Recovery Diaries, which is an online journal that tells real stories of mental illness. And their sort of motto is bust stigma, right? And so that's something I think of a lot. And I like the idea of bust because it kind of gives, like, I don't want to say aggressive, but like a forceful, a power to it, right? Right. So that we can break down these barriers, you know, by talking about it. And for me, it's really only in the last few years I've started talking about my own bipolar disorder and eating disorder as a teenager, which started with me in my graduate program, my MFA program at Bennington, giving a lecture on the representation of mentally ill women in fiction. And I felt like I would be doing a disservice to myself and to my audience to not say, this is me too, and these are my experiences, and I have been institutionalized, and I, you know, I've struggled with depression and anxiety and all of these things. And so for me, that was a big step to talk about my own experience publicly. And that's something I felt it was so liberating. And it also forged these connections with the audience members, many of whom came up to me and said, I've gone through something similar, and thanked me for talking about it. And that really made me realize how important it is to talk about your struggles, how important it is, not just for yourself, but for other people out there who need to hear it and need to know they're not alone. Right. And that was really one of the goals of this collection, is breaking down that stigma that prevents many people from receiving help, receiving the care they need, and from reaching out to the people in their lives. This, which I think is just one of the most important things that we need to do to improve mental health.
Yeah. Let's see. One of the pieces is about a Tinder date during COVID. And it's funny because I've noticed these pandemic stories just starting to pop up, right? And I expect we're going to see a lot more of them. But anyway, did you see a lot of pandemic stories and poems being sent to you?
Several. You know, I started, so the submissions were due August 1st. Mm-hmm. So a lot of folks were working on these as pandemic life was really, you know, settling. Right. So a number of pieces did address the pandemic. And I did include a couple of those in there. And I think that's important because mental health has been a big issue during the pandemic. A lot of folks are feeling isolated or feeling depressed. So I think that was important to me to represent as well.
Yes. Now, what are a few of the creative choices that you asked your authors to make before their work could go into this collection? Is there anything you can think of that you were sort of like, look, this is great, but could we just do this?
Sure. So for instance, there was one author who had written this beautiful piece. I really loved the first draft she gave me, but I felt like she was sort of skirting around the mental health issues a little bit. And I wanted her to dig a little deeper and explore what was preventing barriers to her getting help. What were those feelings really that she was feeling? That was one particular example of something where I really liked the piece and where it was going, but I felt like there was more to it that she wasn't saying yet. And I think that she's really done that in revisions.
Great. All right. You are a poet and a writer of prose yourself, and you have a book of your own coming out later this year. So I want to talk about that in a second. But why didn't you include any of your own work in this collection?
Sure. So some editors do choose to include their work in their collections. It was something I thought about. But honestly, I had so many wonderful submissions that I really didn't feel right excluding one of them or turning one of them down in favor of my own work. And I felt like I do have my own essays and my own essay collection coming out. You know, I do have platforms for my own work, and I really wanted to highlight the voices that had so bravely, you know, offered up their stories. So I had so many difficult decisions to make that one of them was that I don't feel like I can turn down work in favor of my own.
Okay, that's nice. Let's talk for a minute about your forthcoming book. What is that going to be about? And do you have a title yet?
Yes. So my essay collection, Feed Me, will be coming out with Holbrook House Press in 2022. And it is a collection of essays that explores my bipolar disorder, my eating disorder as a teenager, and alcohol addiction in the family, all through the lens of food. So it uses food as sort of the catalyst or the connecting tissue to talk about these issues. And so as I was writing these stories, it occurred to me that so many of my memories center around food, and that for me, food is healing. Food is love. It's a way of sharing myself with other people, creating meals for folks, sharing meals, cooking together is, you know, a huge coping mechanism for me, and something that following my eating disorder as a 13, 14, 15-year-old, I learned to love food again and learned to cook for myself and to feed myself. So that's really what the collection is about sustenance, healing, recovery, and using food as a way to connect with yourself as well as others.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Do you in that collection, do the meals, the food, the beyond just like a theme, do they take on symbolic meaning? I'm just curious.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So one of the things that I want to explore in that collection is the idea of presence and what it feels like to be present. And at times in my life, when I was struggling and dealing with depression, I would dissociate. I would disconnect, right, from myself. And food is a way for me to bring myself back into my body to focus on the flavors and the tastes and the process of creating. So that was really important for me. And for me, food absolutely is symbolism. It's, as I say, it's feeding yourself. It's, you know, the epigraph in my collection is from Carmen Maria Machado, which is, "I fed myself like a woman who needed to love the world again." And I think about that a lot in my own recovery and healing process, is a way, food and feeding myself is a way to both love myself and to love the world.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. I know you mentioned your MFA, but what's your writing background? Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I studied creative writing at Sarah Lawrence College as an undergrad, and then I got my MFA in fiction from the Bennington Writing Seminars in Bennington, Vermont. I have had a number of publications in the online and print journals, as well as a Vermont anthology, Please Do Not Remove, a collection celebrating literature in libraries, Vermont. I have published a number of poems, essays, and fiction stories, short stories. I published a piece a few years ago in HuffPost, and as well as a number of other essays and poems collections. So I currently am working on a short story collection and a poetry collection, in addition to preparing for the essay collection to come out next year.
Wow. Okay, great. So I was going to ask you what you're working on next. So the poetry collection and the short story collection, do you have publishers in mind for those yet, or are you just sort of still working?
Not yet. I'm searching for the right home for both of those. I have put out queries to a few publications that I really like, publishers I really like. I would love to go with a Vermont publisher again. I really like the idea of keeping it local and supporting Vermont literature and Vermont art. So that certainly would be a priority for me if I can make that work.
Now, let's talk about keeping it local. So when you keep it local, how do you get the word out about a book? And also marketing the collection, A Tether to This World. You mentioned that you're setting up some readings. Have you had any difficulty finding venues that wanted to support it, whether it be on Zoom or in person or whatever?
Not really. With a Tether to This World, I've found so far that folks seem to be really supportive and interested in it. I think mental health is a very hot topic right now, particularly during the pandemic. It's something that folks are starting, maybe folks who haven't been paying attention to it as much are starting to, and it's starting to come more into the global conversation, in the national conversation. So my experience so far has been that folks are quite interested in promoting it. I spoke to Rick Sangari on Vermont Viewpoint, on WDEV about the collection. I spoke to our local press, Valley Reporter, about it as well, and trying to get out into a few more places. But so far I've found quite a positive reaction to it. In terms of promoting books during this time, Zoom readings have been wonderful. I've attended many and I've given some as well. That's been a great way to connect with people all over the world. Mm-hmm. One of the positive elements coming out of the pandemic is the ability to connect with readers and writers, you know, all over the place in ways that you may not have been able to previously. And I'm just relying on my writing networks, whether it's through Bennington, whether it's through Sarah Lawrence College, other networks I'm a part of, folks that have published my work in the past. Many of them I've found have been quite supportive of the project.
That's wonderful. Who was the editor at Main Street?
Scott Douglas.
Okay. And when you were working with him, was there anything that he, after you brought him your final collection, were there things that he recommended that you then change further?
No, I was kind of surprised. This was my first time putting together a full collection like this. And I thought that maybe he would have some editorial feedback. And he was like, this looks great. So he was so supportive of this project from day one and gave me total freedom. Well, one other thing I wanted to talk about, I had the opportunity last summer to go to Vermont Studio Center and spend 2 weeks in Johnson, Vermont, putting this book together. Okay. So it followed, I think the submission deadline for the anthology was August 1st, and I started at Vermont Studio Center on August 3rd. So I really dedicated my 2 weeks there to reading these stories again and again, in many cases, really sitting with them and considering them. And I printed all of the ones I was seriously considering out and had them all over the floor of my studio. So just scattered with papers and I'm like jumping in between them all. But that's where I really did the bulk of this work. And so I really want to thank Vermont Studio Center for giving me that opportunity.
Oh, that's wonderful. I just admitted Earl.
Erica, it's nice to see you.
I know.
We didn't talk in email.
I know. I feel like I know you, and now we see each other in person.
I know. I feel like I made a friend through this process. It's really nice
me
to see
you. I'm so glad. I'm so grateful.
I'm Shayla. Nice to meet you.
Hi, Shayla.
Welcome to the conversation. Erica and I are just about wrapped up, and then I have a question that I'll ask both of you later. So I was just going to start, Earl, if you wanted to just talk a little bit. You're a poet. Do you write prose as well?
No prose. Yet.
Okay, great. What's your poetry history? What is your draw to poetry? What do you love about it?
Well, I actually am sort of an emerging poet, I would say. I just turned 50 and I only really attempted poetry about 6 years ago and have sort of now migrated into sort of this sort of second or third chapter of life as a poet. And so far, thus far, you know, my poetry has been it's been fairly narrative, I would say. So it's almost has that prose bit. I always was interested in prose and fiction, but so I've been writing more memoir like poetry thus far.
Okay. All right. Wonderful. Well, I was going to ask if you're comfortable to do so, if you could please read your poem from the collection, and it's called Swimming Back to Zoloft.
I would love to.
Okay.
Swimming Back to Zoloft. Childhood was all about drowning. First in the ocean, a few years later in the river named fear. I was too young to understand this would be a metaphor for my life, or why, despite my misgivings, my father would insist on tossing me into pools, then holding me underneath. Too young to know the brain steeped in this slow brew of cortisol and terror would forever produce depression and dread. At 26, I asked a 16-year-old to teach me, and at the community pool blew bubbles with a group of kindergartners, wore flippers and a mask, learned that to struggle meant to sink, and calm equaled float. In the parking lot, I sat weeping in my car, wet and shaking, unable to breathe. The therapist said the blue pill was like a magical raft that could buoy me for a while until the tremors waned and my jaw unclenched. I climbed aboard after treading the water of my serotonin-deprived mind and divorced myself of the notion I'd ever find shore. But sometimes I still spot land. Can't stop myself from the odd compulsion to test my limits, to taper down and discard that translucent green bottle, to free dive, to fall. Slipping one leg at a time over the side, I let myself drop into the depths where the water seems fine for a while. And I pretend I can swim, and then do swim, taking gulps of the sour water, kicking and kicking, kicking with everything I've got.
Thank you so much for reading that.
I love that poem.
That's a wonderful poem. And well, why don't I just ask Erica to talk about how she read that poem when you first got it for the collection, Erica? Like anything that particularly moved you, stood out? I have my thing that I really was like, I kept coming back to when I read it, but maybe I'll let you start.
Sure. That poem just hit me so hard. And Earl, I was talking earlier about really wanting a sense of hope in each of these pieces and an aspect of recovery. And I think that poem really gives me hope at the end by kicking with everything I've got, really shows working through it, right? And you know, overcoming the struggles in swimming, right? And learning to, you know, you start with childhood was about drowning. And I think about my own childhood with depression and anxiety and that feeling of drowning. And by the end, you're giving it everything you've got and you're swimming, you're floating above, rising above the illness. And so that to me really spoke to me. I thought it was such a beautiful, hopeful poem.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Thank you.
I totally loved the, you know, to struggle is to sink and to be calm is to float. And then it comes back as you go through. It's so great. How did you come to have the piece in the collection?
Well, you know, I saw Erica's call. I saw the call go out. I can't remember where now. It's probably in New Pages or one of the other places where editors put out the calls for poetry and prose. And I've tried to take in my own work. I think this is really important. It's a topic that I think we need to normalize talking about. It was somewhat difficult. I have a public life beyond poetry in terms of career and other things. And so it was somewhat risk-taking, I think, to begin to talk about these things, talk about my upbringing, talk about the things we do as interventions, both in terms of therapy and chemical interventions, and also the struggle we have even after we find those interventions to stick with them, right? There's a, you know, so I think it's really important given sort of the just catastrophic rise in mental illness in this country, particularly the West and America, I think, is to normalize talking about it and normalize getting help and normalize the fact that it's pretty damn normal to have these issues. And so the call really spoke to me in that way, because a lot of my own work circles around sort of self revelation, or, you know, letting the self be out there and greet the other people that are reading it, hopefully. So that was what caught me, brought me to it. And I was thrilled to have this poem accepted into the anthology. Actually, this will be the first, it hasn't been published anywhere else, so this will be the first time it appears. It is in my own collection, but that's the first time I've ever read it too. So it was kind of fun to hear it. I actually never read it out loud, if you can believe that.
That's fabulous. Well, I sort of have one last question that maybe you can both answer, or you can answer, you know, each of you to your own. But I like to finish the interviews with advice for writers. I wondered if Erica, if you have a piece of general advice that will help writers who are considering submitting work to collections. And also, Earl, if you have a piece of advice for people who are considering submitting work to collections, but from the other side of it.
Yes. Well, my biggest piece of writing advice I'm going to steal from the movie Almost Famous, where Philip Seymour Hoffman tells a young aspiring writer to be honest and unmerciful. And I think of that a lot. And I have a little post-it above my desk that says that in my own work, be honest and unmerciful. So, yeah, I think in particular, this collection, the writers were so brave in speaking about their own deeply personal experiences. And so I think when you're submitting to collections, to certainly polish your work and make sure it's the best it can be, but also to really dig deep and try to expose yourself and your own work, whether it's prose or poetry, to really find a place in your work where you're able to be the most honest and brave and open.
Wonderful. Earl, do you have anything you'd add to that?
Well, I agree with everything Erica said. I think, you know, most people come to poetry, I think, at least historically, through anthologies. Now, of course, we're talking about an anthology that includes both prose and poetry. But I think that's one of the reasons it's so important to find a family of work where you can submit your work and get exposure to, because, you know, all writers do want readers.
Yeah.
And that's another way to uncover readers and to find out where your own unique voice, you know, sort of places in the chorus of those other writers, I think. As it relates to writing, I mean, Erica said it really well. I have and I will forget the famous writer who clearly must have said this, but basically I heard once that, you know, to be a good writer, you need to write as if you and everyone you've ever known is dead. And I think that's one of the things that came to mind. And I remind myself a lot when I shy away from exposing and offering my whole self in anything I'm writing. Because I think by offering our whole self in the writing, that's where it resonates as true and evokes real feeling, real compassion for self within the readers that are reading. And without doing that, we're not really touching each other. And I think that's what this is for.
Yeah.
So do that, right? Always do that. And if you have to pretend that you and everyone you've ever known is no longer here to read it.
That reminds me of an Anne Lamott quote. There's so many, but I remember this one from Bird by Bird where she says, you know, you're sitting there working and all of your dead relatives pull up behind you on chairs with their coppery breath.
Oh, I like coppery breath. Coppery breath. That's nice. Yeah. That's
so
very
long.
Nice. For a poem.
How's your collection coming, Earl?
It's good. We're going into pre-sales. Advanced sales will start in July and should be out before Thanksgiving, hopefully.
Oh, wonderful.
I'm very excited.
What's your collection?
It's my debut collection of poetry. It's actually being published by the same as how I met Erica. It's the same publisher, Main Street Rag. And it's called Any Dumb Animal. And it's basically a memoir in verse that sort of tells my story coming out in the rural religious South. Coming up and coming out in the rural religious South, sort of in the 90s during at the height of the AIDS crisis. But then it flashes forward and back and spans like 30 years.
Wow.
So I'm really excited about it.
That's great. I'm speaking with Erica Nichols Fraser and A.E. Hines, and we're talking about A Tether to This World, which is a new collection of work edited by Erica. And A.E. Hines has a piece in it, as do many, many, many people. It's thematically related to mental illness, and it's published by Main Street Rag. Thank you both so much for speaking with me.
Shayla, thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
From the Media Factory in the South End of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was a combined interview with Erica Nichols Fraser and A.E. Hines about the new collection, A Tether to This World, Stories and Poems About Recovery, published by Main Street Rag. You can learn more about their work at their individual websites, NicholsFraser.com and AEHines.net. I have two Write the Book prompts this week, thanks to the generosity of my guests. Erica Nichols Fraser credits hers to the poet Chelsea Diane, who posts on Instagram at Poets and Peonies. Write a letter to yourself that starts with the phrase, I forgive you. And Earl, who, as we now know, publishes under A.E. Hines, shares the following exercise that flows naturally from his own work in the anthology A Tether to This World. Practice self-exposure. Pick one moment from your past or a personal circumstance that stands out in your mind but is embarrassing or makes you at least slightly uneasy when sharing it. Now write a short poem about that experience using either second or third person, as if you're telling the story about someone else. It doesn't have to be a big thing. It could be something you did, a mistake you made, or something that happened to you due to no fault of your own. The only requirement is that writing about it puts a twinge of angst in your belly. When you're done, change the point of view back to first person and see what happens. Did you learn anything new about the situation? Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. There will be a reading from A Tether to This World on Friday, May 28th at 8 p.m. on Zoom. And you can learn more information about that reading by visiting Erica's website, NicholsFraser.com. And earlier that same week, on Tuesday, May 25th at 7, Erica will be a part of a Bennington alumni reading. She'll be reading from her own forthcoming book by way of Bennington alumni's Facebook Live. Every week, I give a little pandemic update. I'm sure that you know that numbers in this country are getting better. Vaccinations are going up. COVID, hopefully, is coming down. But in the meantime, we still are trying to be safe and careful. So as I say every week, specific to writers and readers, please try to find the books that have come out, even as book tours have been canceled. Everything, as you just heard, a lot of things are still virtual. So, you know, I know we're getting tired of Zoom, but it's still wonderful to hear people read from their work. It's wonderful that so many people from all over the world can attend each other's events. So try to find the authors whose books have come out and try to attend their events. I hope that you're able to read and to write. Keep in mind that the archives of Write the Book offer weekly writing prompts to help you in your work. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. I said this last time, too. I'm going to have a change in format coming up on the show. Before I formalize that, I'd love to hear from as many of you as possible about the things you do and do not like about Write the Book and what you might like to see change. If you do like the show, please rate it where you find it and like it on the social media sites that you use. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, which is writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, Pandora, and other sites where you get your podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.